Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Right now, in the wake of the Parkland, Florida shooting, there are a lot of people asking questions about the way we raise boys in our culture. Almost all of the perpetrators of mass shootings are men or boys. So what are we doing wrong? While the most recent tragedy has brought this conversation to the forefront, it is not a brand new conversation. This week, the University of Iowa will be hosting a free What About Men Summit on Wednesday afternoon at the Iowa Memorial Union. The goal is to explore the many ways that our cultural idea or ideal of masculinity negatively impacts boys, men, and all of us. My first guest today has been thinking about this question for a long time. Bryant Smith is the author of Manhood, The Missing Manual, and the keynote speaker at the summit. Hello, Bryant.
Hello. How are you, Charity?
Great. Thank you so much for talking to me. And I know that you grew up in an urban environment on the south side of Chicago. When you were growing up, what do you think your idea of manhood was?
Oh, when I was growing up, my ideal of manhood was you had to be a provider. You had to be a tough guy. You had to be able to fight and defend yourself, and you were had to be able to dominate other people, primarily women and smaller people, and all of those things. It was all about being rough, tough, and responsible.
So when you went off to college and you encountered people who had not grown up in an urban environment, how did that idea of manhood shape how you thought about other people?
I just assumed that if you had not had the experiences that I had had, that means if you had never been on public transportation, if you had never been chased by street gangs, if you had never had to protect yourself or to fight to keep from being robbed, then there's no way you could be a man. So all of those guys that I met who had grown up in the suburbs or in small towns and had never been on the L train or any other form of public transportation, they couldn't possibly be men in my mind.
When did you start to question that idea, that way of looking at the world?
I didn't start to question that until I actually got into graduate school. So I had graduated college, worked for 2 years, and then went back to grad school. And I was introduced to a guy by the name of Dr. Naeem Akbar and his readings. And once I started reading his work, particularly on visions for black manhood, it changed my whole way of thinking and my thought processes.
Tell me how it changed your thinking.
Well, one of the things it did was it started making me realize that what I had been participating in was this thing called conditional manhood, that the conditions that you grew up in determine what type of man you could be, or even if you were a man. And I really started to wrestle with the idea that it wasn't a condition, it was a concept of manhood that we really needed to promote. And so by his readings and attending some conferences and meeting other men who were strong in their own identity, who knew who they were both culturally and personally, had a connection to a family and a community, those things taught me the stuff that was more important about my manhood than the conditions that I grew up in.
And this idea of manhood, although, you know, we've talked about the fact that you grew up on the south side of Chicago, this idea of manhood seems to stretch across different kinds of experiences, the idea that your experience is what makes you a man.
Oh, yes, certainly. Most men grow up believing in conditional manhood. They believe that the conditions that they have found themselves in are directly related to the type of men they either are or are going to become. So if you grew up in a responsible environment where you had a male showing you how to go to work, how to tie ties, all of those things play into the type of man that you either believe that you're going to be or that you are, and how you evaluate other men.
It's interesting when you think about the idea of becoming a man, because in our culture, we seem to like to pinpoint a moment. While, of course, it's a process that takes many years and many different experiences, we like to think of it as something that can be achieved or earned in a moment.
Yes. Most people believe that the condition, if you ask any group of men, when did you become a man? You can get a variety of ages, but if you say, well, what happened to you at that particular age, they can tell you an event in my own experience, I've met people who, when I say, when did you become a man? It could be as simple to them as when they lost their virginity, when they had their first drink of alcohol, when they used illicit drugs, or even when they committed their first act of violence, or if they're paying the bills. You know, those are all things that they point to and say, at that point, I knew I was a man. And unfortunately, in America, violence plays heavily into your becoming a man. I think our whole country's history, men were the ones who allegedly went out and conquered this nation and tamed it from the wild people who were here originally. And that's how you became a man. You had to prove yourself.
And you feel like this idea that, violence is often the defining moment or the defining characteristic, that's something that crosses across racial boundaries and social economic boundaries?
Oh, yes, it does. It crosses racial and social economic boundaries. And it doesn't matter whether you grew up in an urban environment or a rural setting. All of these people or this concept of you're not a man until you can dominate other people. And sometimes it's in sports, but it's still a violent act. And if you are a person who decides, I don't want to participate in that, even though you may be comfortable in your manhood, most males around you will never accept your manhood because you refuse to prove it.
Let's talk about your idea that this missing manual for becoming a man. What do you think's missing? What would be in that manual if you could give it to people?
Yeah, well, it's one of those things where if you ask a person, what happened to you? Yesterday you were a boy, today you're a man, so what happened to you? They can tell you what happened to you, and so it's like, poof, all of a sudden I'm a man, but I didn't get any instruction. I just became a man. So in this missing manual, I say that there are things like, one, you have to know who you are if you want to really be a man. You know, what does that mean? How much of an investment are you putting into yourself to understand what manhood is? Two, there's something called the... sort of, if you want to compare it to something, think of it when you buy a computer, and each computer, in order for the software to work on that computer, it has to have some basic operating systems, and those systems have certain requirements. So that's how it is with this manhood missing, the missing manual, and what should be included in it. You have some basic system requirements in order for you to call yourself a man. And so I talk about what those system requirements are. And what I really like to say is after you sit there and you listen to the keynote, what you're actually getting is a software update so that your system's going to run fully as a man.
So a lot of the things that you talk about, knowing how to love yourself and accept yourself, being willing to forgive others, these are ideas that in our culture we think about as more feminine.
Yes, we do. Which is why that's the irony of it. Because we attribute these things to being a kind person, gentle person, understanding your rights, being responsible, because we generally make those attributes those that are feminine, men shy away from them. We don't talk about these things. Of course, we show no emotions. I mean, there's lots of things that come about as a man that you have to have control over and an understanding of that we just say, hey, that's what it means to be a woman. And the irony in that is, even when women do it, we don't give them any credit. It's not given the same amount of weight. But we definitely don't want our boys to do it. I mean, it's sort of like when you, from day one, when you're born, you're going to get a blue blanket or a pink blanket, you know, and you're going to get this set of skills and these impressions that are going to tell you that these are the things that men have and should do and the way men should feel, think, and act, and this is the way that women should feel, think, and act. And unfortunately, the true things that make you a man are often attributed as female characteristics and qualities.
So when you first started sharing these ideas and opening up these conversations with people, what kind of a reaction did you get?
Well, I'm what we call a guy who promotes the concept of critical thinking. And so I always tell people right up front, I'm not here to make you agree with me. But in order for you to disagree with me, you're going to have to think about what I'm saying. And that's all I ever ask people to do. Think about what I'm saying and apply it. If it works for you, apply it. If not, then you have to be able to introduce something better and help someone else understand it. And maybe we should be applying that. So I met some resistance. Most of the people, I generally hit them with so much at one time that they are kind of overwhelmed and they are in a very reflective process and state of being. So I don't get a lot of pushback from the initial conversation about the things that you are missing as a man and calling people's manhood into question and trying to get them to rethink manhood. Later on, after they've done something, I get something like, oh, but what about this? There's always somebody who wants to come up with an example and say, well, you know, what about this? A person who has gone through these experiences. And I'm like, I'm here to tell you that conceptual manhood will overcome any condition you find yourself in. That's the main difference between being a person who believes in conditional manhood and believing in conceptual manhood. If you believe in conditional manhood, then you're subject to those conditions. And if you believe in conceptual manhood, then conditions don't matter.
What advice would you give to parents who really want to do better for their boys?
Other than buy my book, I would tell them that they need to have a true understanding of where this process is broken down. Because if you look at manhood, I mean, you just gave the perfect example at the start of the show. You talked about all of the violence and the majority of these mass shootings being committed by males. So we obviously have something going wrong. So what harm could it do for us to rethink and try something different? So my advice would be that as parents, we need to start putting more emphasis on value-based manhood as opposed to condition or experience-based manhood. Like, just like parents will go out and they'll buy their sons basketballs or baseballs and make sure that they get all of the training that they need to be the best basketball or baseball player, we need to start doing that about their manhood. We need to put them in spaces where they get a new and different understanding of manhood, where it's going to be okay for them to learn about their emotions, where it's going to be okay for them to experience and display acts of kindness. It's going to be okay for them to understand and show love and affection, build positive relationships. They're going to understand what it means to forgive someone and how to be forgiven. They're going to understand the value of making mistakes. So there's a whole list of things that they need beyond physical acts of violence and aggression and this whole concept of being a certain size physically. And, you know, there's so much more that they've got to get.
Bryant Smith, thank you so much.
Oh, no, thank you for inviting me and allowing me to share just a little bit with you.
Bryant Smith is the author of Manhood, The Missing Manual. He is also the keynote speaker at the What About Men Summit at the University of Iowa coming up on Wednesday. We'll continue talking about modern manhood in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about efforts to redefine or reclaim masculinity. There's a summit taking place at the University of Iowa on Wednesday. The title is What About Men? The goal is to explore the many ways that our cultural ideas or ideals of masculinity negatively impact boys, men, and all of us. Three of the men who will be involved in the summit are here with me now. Patrick Galligan is a licensed staff psychologist at the University of Iowa. Hi, Patrick.
Thanks for having me, Charity.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. Also, Cody Howell, violence prevention specialist at the Women's Resource and Action Center at the University of Iowa, is here. Hello, Cody.
Hi, glad to be here.
And Adam Robinson, executive director at Rape Victim Advocacy Program. Hello, Adam.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And Patrick, I'll start with you. Tell me a little bit about how the summit came to be.
Well, I think that at the very beginning of the year, one of our campus offices that's really defined as a place where, I guess I'll just name it, the Office of Sexual Misconduct and Response Coordinator brought together a bunch of folks around campus who do work around men and masculinities. And to be honest, it was just sort of to see that we all do this work and maybe we don't have as much communication as we should. So I guess there's sort of a parallel process in bringing men together to communicate a little bit more effectively. But it was a really meaningful way that we could get connected and talk about ways that we could collaborate a little bit more.
So it was a response to sexual violence on campus. Mm-hmm. And okay, how can we deal with that more effectively? How did that grow into this? I mean, a session or an afternoon really looking at many different aspects of masculinity.
I think the charge to us was get to know each other, first of all. And after we spent several meetings doing so, at least I can speak for myself. I think we felt like we needed to do something to take sort of a more active stance on campus and come together to collaborate in this way. So we thought that a summit that focuses on this work that we all do, but in a really intentional way and bringing together experts who could talk to mentors, both on campus and the community, would be a really meaningful way to do something and hopefully have it grow into something bigger in future years.
Well, the sessions don't just focus on consent and healthy relationships and a lot of the things that we talk about when we talk about preventing sexual violence. Was there a moment, a light bulb moment, when you guys were talking to each other and thought, you know, this has to be bigger than that? Adam?
Yeah, I think, one of the realities that we face in all the different aspects of this work that we have the privilege of doing is that whether we're talking about dating violence or domestic abuse or sexual violence or even gun violence, the reality that gender is a piece of all of it. It's a kind of that overlapping Venn diagram, and gender's in the center of all of that. And so to have a space to have some real honest reflection and dialogue and discussion, as Bryant mentioned in the earlier segment, we don't often talk about this. And so we want to have some space to talk about it. And the reality is that it has implications broadly in personal relationships and family relationships and certainly in the community as we're all aligned to try and reduce violence.
The summit in talking about masculinity and some of our unfair expectations for men, for boys as they grow, it's not just about the fact that there are some very serious problems of violence that have grown out of this climate or this culture of masculinity, but you also feel like boys and men are getting shortchanged by this culture. Cody, do you have some thoughts on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think from a very early age, boys and men are not given the space or the ability to explore themselves creatively, explore their options for what it means to have expression outside of anger. That's the go-to and the accepted form of expression for men and boys is anger or frustration and, you know, the don't get mad, get sad, or don't get sad, get mad.
Right.
And, you know, I think that there's so much more that boys need to have in order to feel like they can express themselves. And we need to be giving that space. We need to be giving those options, because when we stifle that, we create a culture that pushes men into this small box of expression. And we're not creating that space for them to explore what help-seeking attitudes or attitudes that ask for assistance when they might need it, or what they need for accommodations when it comes to mental health, safety and security, and even how to engage in helpful conversations around their relationships. So we need to be giving that to them. And I just don't know if we have the scripts available yet. And as we work through some of that, that's what we're hoping that we can give is more authentic scripts for parents, mentors, teachers, coaches, to give them some ways that they can express what they need, ways to express their feelings, ways to express their wants and desires in ways that don't just end in aggression or anger. So we're hoping that we can kind of change the way we give boys and men scripts. So hopefully we can, you know, give them a broader definition of manhood that they define themselves. So whether that's thinking more creatively or asking more questions and being more curious and giving the space to express emotions, we're hoping that we can change that culturally so that men and boys aren't forced into this man box that we created at a very early age. We want to make sure that we're giving them as much autonomy and to define their manhood for themselves as we can.
Now, in putting the summit together, all of you must have spent some time thinking about your own personal experiences. So, Patrick, reflect a little bit on that. And when you were growing up, when you look back now, what kind of messages do you think were being sent about what it means to become a man?
Yeah, well, I think the stereotypical things that we often hear about, the sort of male tropes of being strong and not showing weakness. I remember so many times where I think I was policed into being a certain way as a man, not showing weakness and trying to embody strength in some way. And I admittedly say today, and sort of embrace it, that being a little bit more sensitive of a little guy was difficult in that. And then I saw myself then policing other little boys into what masculinity should be. So I know I was shaped by and shaped others' masculinities. So I know that that restrictive process around what it means to show affection, grief, vulnerability was in some way circumscribed for me growing up. And I think the piece that I feel really motivated around is to help other folks who identify as men and boys to not feel circumscribed in that way, to feel like they have a broader range of expression. And becoming a dad of a little boy about a month ago.
It, congratulations. Thank you.
Renews that for me. Makes me want to find ways that the men and boys in my life can be more authentic.
Adam, do you have anything you want to add to thinking about when you were growing up?
Yeah, I think similarly to what Patrick mentioned, and I am grateful I had some amazing mentors and some really healthy models as men, and even the women in my life were strong mentors of mine and understanding my identity. And yet, as healthy as all of those influences were, I still very clearly had some expectations that kept me stuck and still keep me stuck. I still have to work to unlearn. Similar to Patrick, I've got two little ones at home, and I find myself being really aware of the messages that I'm giving them and trying to offer as much space for their identity to flourish and exist without cutting back on that, because society is going to do that. And that's really, I think, part of the opportunity in this work and the summit Wednesdays. I think it's really important to add, as we're kind of stepping in and creating some of these spaces, the reality that these spaces have been created by women for decades. And so it's really important that as men, we join with women and join with all genders to be part of this movement, to understand that the ways in which we expect boys and men to be boys and men has been toxic, and not all toxic. Mm-hmm. So how do we kind of lean into the parts that we want to celebrate and carry forward, but also really have some honest dialogue back and forth so that we can push through some of those kind of old and toxic expectations that perpetuate all these different forms of violence.
Well, it is interesting that you say that women have created these spaces for a long time. And I do think about that. Over the last really 50 years, mm-hmm. there has been a concerted effort on the part of many women and right. also men to help women break out of those prescribed gender roles. There's been a lot of thought and a lot of writing and a lot of protest and, yeah. and a lot of efforts at policy change. And many would say the work is not done. But there has not been a similar movement for men. Do you feel like in some ways our ideas of masculinity are at least 50 years old?
Absolutely. And that's where I think, again, and part of privilege is the opportunity not to have to see things. Right. So I've known since I was a child which box to check when it came to gender. But I never really had to feel male. I didn't. Right. Because the society set up for me. I look on movies and listen to music and I see and experience people that look like me and identify like me. I see them in the world. And there's lots of intersections with that, too, with race and lots of other components of identity, but pertaining to gender, I never really had to think about that in the same way that when I started to work at a rape crisis center about 12 years ago, and then really realized the weight of gender and the majority of folks that I worked with there had been harmed by someone that was male. And so that impacted the lens that they saw me through. And so that was, I think, a space to push our privilege back in front of our face and really lean into it, because I think the natural thing to do is kind of retract back or get defensive, and that doesn't lead to any sort of change.
We're talking this hour about what it means to be a man in America today and also redefining masculinity. There's a summit taking place at the University of Iowa on Wednesday called What About Men? We're getting a little preview of that summit today. And with me, Patrick Galligan, licensed staff psychologist at the University of Iowa, Adam Robinson, executive director of the Rape Victim Advocacy Program, and Cody Howell, violence prevention specialist at the Women's Resource and Action Center at the University of Iowa. And Cody, I mean, what about you? When you reflect on your childhood growing up and some of the forces that shaped you?
Yeah, so I mean, I grew up in Montana, so big cowboy culture there. And, you know, there was the strong influences on that. But I had a lot of support from my family, from my friends to explore what manhood meant for myself. So, you know, I was a theater kid. I did a lot of dance. I did a lot of arts and was always supported in that. But when I went to college, I chose to join a fraternity. I was indoctrinated into a culture that is, you know, very white, very masculine. And I felt a lot of pressure to adhere to those norms, but also to police others into those norms. And I think that that was something that was a really eye-opening experience, that while being in a fraternity that was pretty progressive for the campus, still, like, feeling that pressure of, like, you know, white hegemonic masculinity, you know, to push that into other people and to say, like, you have to adhere to this norm in order to be accepted into this kind of culture. And, you know, I think I had to push back a bit against that a little bit, but I still felt myself kind of, you know, leaning into what it meant to be a man and saying, like, okay, will people accept me if they understand that I express myself differently or identify in a certain way? So it was an eye-opening experience and kind of led me to the work that I do now, and realizing that, you know, like Adam had said, that this was, you know, doing anti-violence work has been, for the large part, championed by women.
But it's been considered to be a women's issue.
Right. And when we look at that, you know, and a lot of people consider this a women's issue, but when you look at it, men commit violence across the board in the vast majority. And so what we need to be doing is switching that script from a woman's issue to it's a men's issue, and men need to be, you know, saying to other men, how do we stop this violence? How do we talk to each other to make this violence disappear? How do we have a better culture shift that men are leading to create safer spaces, to create lines of communication? And I think we need to not let it be a woman's issue and say that this is something that we're going to just, like, let women tackle, because we're not going to change that culture if we don't say men need to step up and step in and start having these conversations. So I got into this role and immediately I made my boss very aware I needed to, like, take on men and masculinity's work, because that was what I'm passionate about and they were all for it. But I know that it's a space where I get a lot of questions about, and I get a lot of questions about, why are you a man doing anti-violence work when this has been a woman's issue? And I say, you know, it's a man's issue because we have to change that culture that men commit violence against women far often than we would like to say it actually happens.
Well, and also there's a news story that just broke over the weekend. A prominent Iowa AAU coach has been dismissed amid a pornography investigation. Many young men victims in that situation. We see that a lot where, mm-hmm. I mean, not just girls, not just women are victims of violence, mm-hmm. sexual violence, this kind of rape culture, but boys and men as well. And my heart breaks, and of course, any of these stories, but I also think about young boys who may have been victimized in mm-hmm. that way and having maybe even more limited opportunities to express themselves and to get the help that they need to deal with that.
Absolutely. And we know that's to be true. And I think a lot of young boys who experience sexual violence at a young age aren't able to come forward, aren't able to talk about that experience, because there's the myth that boys don't get raped mm-hmm. and boys don't experience sexual abuse. And, you know, a lot of this happens behind closed doors with most times people that they know and people that they trust. And we need to create that ability that we don't stigmatize sexual violence against boys, that we say we need to change that. We need to make sure that when survivors come forward, we're not stigmatizing, we're not blaming them, which is our culture, which we blame survivors when they come forward. And we make that about, what did you do to deserve this? But we need to change that, because boys and men aren't coming forward until it's far too late.
I want to open the phones. You're welcome to join the conversation, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Sharon is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Sharon.
Hello.
Hi, what would you like to talk about?
Well, I was thinking with my own sons, as they grew older, I would, when they were younger, I was the one that was, I was a stay-at-home mom, and, you know, I was the one that always hugging and, you know, doing that role. And then I've noticed as the boys got older and into high school, they kind of shied away from me, and they, their dad stepped in and was the, you know, was the embracer. And I just think And then as they got older again, then they're more open to, you know, hugging their mom and stuff. But there is this time when they're very accepting of the dad's role of being the hugger and the embracer.
Well, Sharon,
that was never planned. It just happened.
Yeah, thank you so much for bringing that up. And it sounds like your boys were extremely fortunate in having a strong and confident male role model in their life who was comfortable showing affection. But I mean, that's another issue that a lot of young men and adult men have is the difficulty in showing affection. Patrick?
Yeah, I think a lot of young boys and men are sort of hungry for that affection. And I'm not surprised that Sharon's kids turn towards a man for that, because there are so many young men who are hungry for affection, not just broadly, but from other men as well. And we don't really talk about or teach young men how to search that out in other men.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking about redefining masculinity this hour. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about efforts to redefine or reclaim masculinity. There's a summit taking place at the University of Iowa this Wednesday afternoon at the Iowa Memorial Union. It's called What About Men? And it's an exploration of the many ways that our cultural idea of masculinity negatively impacts not just culture in general, but boys and men as well. And with me this hour, three men who are involved in the summit. Patrick Galligan is here, licensed staff psychologist at the University of Iowa. Cody Howell, violence prevention specialist at the Women's Resource and Action Center at the University of Iowa. And Adam Robinson, who's the executive director of the Rape Victim Advocacy Program. And you're welcome to join the conversation as well. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And I want to return to, we were just talking about sometimes the difficulty that boys and men have in showing affection, whether it's for family members, whether it's for each other. This can be a real issue for a lot of men. And I recently watched a documentary about how that seems to negatively impact male friendships, especially in junior high and high school and many years beyond, where the line that the boys were saying was, you know, in one of the researchers was asking young men about their relationships with other boys, and they would say, oh, no homo, you know, as if just having a male friend indicted their own masculinity and their own sexuality. I mean, as a staff psychologist, Patrick, I mean, do you see a lot of men really struggling with this isolation, this inability to connect with other men?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the things that first got me interested in doing men and masculinity's work is how mental health concerns express really differently in men. And for a lot of the clients that I work with who identify as women, they present in a sort of more, I don't know, typical way that we expect depression to look. They might be tearful and express sadness, but with men, it's anger and namely isolation. So that idea of pulling away from others really felt characteristic of a lot of the men that I work with. And one of the, I think, antidotes, antiquated term for depression is to be in connection with other people. And when we, as a society, make it really difficult for men to feel connected to others in their life broadly, working with folks around mental health concerns like depression or anxiety or social anxiety, substance use, becomes really, really challenging when the framework from which they're working is already independence and isolation. In fact, that's sort of broadly defining what it means to be a man, is to be sort of solitary and be able to stand on your own, to be independent. And I think it's crucial that men learn to be closer to others.
In talking about masculinity and trying to redefine masculinity, have any of you gotten any pushback from people? I know that some people can feel like this is very threatening. I know your goal is not to say you can't be a man, you can't be strong, these things are wrong. But what kind of pushback are you hearing from people, Cody?
Yeah, so I think a lot of the pushback comes from, we're upsetting the status quo, and we're saying, you know, we're asking for space to be ourselves and be authentic and to express ourselves differently. But that upsets a lot of the status quo that is around men and manhood and masculinities. And people don't like that. People don't like it when we're asking to change the way that people look at the world around them, because that means that they have to reevaluate themselves and have to look inward and say, am I doing something that might be potentially harmful to the people around me? And so I think that that's the hard part, is saying, like, maybe I've actually hurt somebody with my masculinity, and maybe I've hurt somebody by the way I view what a man should be. And I think that that's the immediate thing is, you know, people say, you know, a guy should be like this, or real men do this, which I think is one of the most weird things, because masculinity looks different across all different cultures. And to say, you know, real men do something is very limiting.
I think part of what I find pretty difficult about having conversations with men about this, and where the pushback comes in, is from a systemic standpoint, too. We're challenging men's power and taking away that ability to be thought of as sort of primary in lots of spaces that men occupy. So the pushback comes then when they realize that I may be losing status. So that can be particularly difficult, I think, for a lot of men to really dig into this kind of conversation.
Adam?
I think the kind of other areas that we get pushback in, too, is the end result of toxic masculinity often is abuse and violence. And so there's a lot of individuals and certainly a lot of men that will push back and say, well, I have not committed abuse. I have not acted out violently, which is absolutely true.
And most men have not.
Absolutely true,
yeah.
Right? And yet, are we collectively, all genders included, still only having a binary discussion with gender too mm-hmm. much? We need to broaden that as well. And collectively, we're creating these systems of what it means to be a male. So while our efforts, and certainly the summit on Wednesday, isn't to convince somebody who's planning to sexually assault somebody not to do that, right? That realistically, that may not be where we reach. But can we influence those that create a space where that is less acceptable behavior, and where it's easier for someone who's experienced sexual violence or domestic abuse or dating violence to come forward in the wake of that and have a safer community to disclose in? That's really what we're trying to do, right? Engage well-meaning individuals and certainly well-meaning men. But it means challenging our privilege, and that is uncomfortable. That is painful.
Let's go back to the phones. Gail is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Gail.
Hello.
Hi. What would you like to talk about?
It's Dale, actually.
Oh, okay. Hi, Dale.
The question I'd like to ask is, in all this discussion, is what part women play in actually developing and creating and maintaining the kinds of roles that it's extreme, which I think what you're talking about, that this doesn't just happen out of some sort of totally, I don't know, inherent property. I mean, I can even think about just the sort of simple acts of courtesy that we don't even question, which is, why do I need to let a woman enter an elevator first? Why do I need to open a door? I frequently encounter this. You come up to a situation like that, and it's an unspoken expectation that I'm supposed to be performing this duty as if that somehow this woman's helpless. I think that's just a small example of how that men get mixed messages from women about what they're supposed to be.
Yeah, Dale, that's a really interesting point. Who'd like to respond to that? I mean, what role women play in creating and perpetuating traditional masculine roles for men?
Right. So I think it's important to recognize that we live in a very patriarchal society, right? And we all have a role to play in that, and a lot of us have to assimilate to that in order to survive in it. So, you know, we tell people that in order to not break that status quo, to not go against the grain, to perform in some of these acts that might be traditionally masculine or traditionally feminine. And when we break that, people question us. And so when somebody says, like, well, I don't want you to do this, or I don't need you to do that for me, we get pushback and we get recourse from that. And so, you know, women still can play roles in shaping, toxic or unhealthy masculinity by perpetuating some ideas about patriarchy and expressing ideas that real men should only do this or real boys should only do that. And we need to be able to flip that script and say, masculinity can look a lot of different ways. What does that mean for you? What do you need from me as somebody who is looking to help you define what that means? So, you know, men and women can ask each other all these questions. And it's not to say that, you know, it's only a men's issue and that these aren't innate traits for men and women. We all have human emotions. We all have the ability to feel and think critically. But, you know, when we stifle that and we say, real men only do this, which I've heard from both men and women, you know, I see that across the board. But we need to say, you know, those are harmful things that can stifle people's expression, creativity, access to help, access to connection. So we know that that's not helpful. And I see that across the board with men and women. But women do play that role in also pushing men back into that man box and saying, I'll only appreciate you if you live up to this expectation that I deem as manly. And we got to change that script, you know, say, I value who you are as a person because you can exhibit a lot of type of feelings and not just because you fit the definition that society puts out there for men.
Well, and some of the things that I was mentioned at the beginning of the show, some of those lines that men and boys hear all the time when they're growing up, man up, boys don't cry, mm-hmm. don't be a sissy. I hear that coming out of the mouths of women just as often as I hear it coming out of the mouths of men. I mean, we're all part of this culture, right?
Mm-hmm.
I want to ask you, thinking about the summit, your initial response when you started putting this together was to focus on coaching culture. So, I mean, I understand why you decided to broaden it, but what did you see about coaching culture that made you say, hey, we really need to address this? Who wants to take that one? Adam?
Sure. I think that, again, there's just so many opportunities where we have people in positions of power and with the ability to mentor and model, and coaches have just tons of surface area with kids. And the other, it was a logical place to start, I think, with us. And then the other reality of this summit, as Patrick mentioned at the beginning here, that we've been meeting as allies on campus and allies in the community that are doing versions of this work parallel to one another. And so what we wanted to do is really in the summit create a space where we can kind of come together and everybody kind of bring their own niche to this violence prevention and masculinity exploration. So we have a great partner in Alan Heisterkamp at the University of Northern Iowa, and he's been doing some great work with coaches, facilitating coaching boys into men, which will be one of the breakouts at the summit. And as we started with that, then we realized, oh, and we've got all these other campus partners and community partners that do different versions of masculinity work. And so the summit was just a really logical place to build and scaffold for that.
Here's a question from Reed. He says, the discussion today is focusing on psychological, sociological, and emotional factors. To what extent are males hardwired for the behavior they sometimes exhibit? I mean, there is a biological difference between men and women. Do you want to try to tackle that, Patrick?
I will try to tackle that one. Yeah,
it's a big one.
One of the things that I often emphasize to folks is this expectation that boys are hardwired to be emotionally different is actually relatively false. The fact that infants, when they're born, research indicates that infants that are coded as boys at birth are actually more emotional and sort of verbal in their expressions of distress than young girls are. So this idea that emotionality is somehow inherently feminine is actually false, just by the way that our infants express themselves. And I don't know that the small differences that we see in, for example, hormone production by folks of different genders is enough to explain sort of the differences that actually exhibit themselves in how we express gender.
We've invested a lot in our idea of testosterone.
Right, exactly. And the fact that women produce testosterone as well doesn't also excuse the different kinds. It's not enough evidence to excuse the different kinds of behaviors that we see in folks who identify as male.
Here's a thought and a question from David in Cedar Rapids. He says, as a parent of two elementary school age boys, I agree there's a crisis of masculinity, for example, what it means to be a man in the United States in the 21st century, but only because there's a constant drumbeat to treat boys like defective girls and masculinity as toxic, itself a derisive value judgment. Even last week, the alternative narratives of mental health versus gun control, both valid positions upon which reasonable people can disagree. The response by the left, aired by All Things Considered, was this wasn't about institutionalizing mentally disabled and ill, but about angry men and boys in general. there was no counterpoint to that narrative that I heard. So that's a really interesting part of this discussion. I haven't heard from any of you today saying that it's a bad thing to be a boy or a bad thing to be a man. But there is, again, there's this concern that we are telling boys that not only have we told them that they can't feel and they can't think and all of the things that you guys have been talking about, but now we're telling them, hey, there's something wrong with you just because you're a boy.
Right.
Everybody wants to respond to that. Adam, you can go first.
Sure. So I think, where to start? And it's a, you know, it's an important point. I think a lot of the really focused kind of energy that we've got, right, is we want to reduce sexual violence, we want to reduce domestic abuse and dating violence. These acts happen way too frequently still in 2018 to say that the women have been leading this movement for decades and we're still to the place that we are. We've made some great movement together, but we've still got a long way to go. And I think part of what we're trying to push forward too is just the reality that the violent acts and the toxic aspects of gender are not because we're wired that way. It's that what we're positing, right, is that young men and young boys, aren't afforded space to feel really human emotions like embarrassment and failure and insecurity and sadness and fear. And so when they don't, that they bottle that up, they isolate generally, and then it gets acted out. That anger either gets acted out on the world or gets acted out internally. And that's where the work that Patrick does and his colleagues is so important so that we can work on that. But as human beings, we all need connection and contact. And so that's where it's not a feminine thing or a masculine thing. That's a human thing. And just as a quick anecdote kind of example of that, if a baby is born prematurely, they can be incubated and have clean oxygen and an IV fluid. They won't thrive if they're not physically touched skin to skin. And that's because at that developmental level, that's how we understand contact, is by touch. And as 19-year-olds and 29-year-olds and 59-year-olds, we still need that amount of contact. And so we're trying to create a safe space and a healthy space for men to be part of that.
So this is a pro-boy, pro-men movement. We only have about 30 seconds left, Patrick, but what do you want to add to that?
Yeah, I think approaching the work that we do from a deficit model of masculinity is the wrong take to have, that we need to sort of fix men. Like, there is substantial work to be done, but there's also a lot to embrace about masculinity too. And in the work that I do and the clients that I see for therapy, it's also about, like, let's find the strengths that you have as a man and the ways that you can express yourself right now and sort of marshal them to help you express yourself more effectively while giving you some more tools for your tool belt, so to speak.
Well, Patrick Galligan, thank you so much for talking with me.
Of course, thanks for having us.
Patrick Galligan, licensed staff psychologist at the University of Iowa. Cody Howell, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much as well.
Cody Howell, violence prevention specialist at the Women's Resource and Action Center at the University of Iowa. And Adam Robinson, thank you.
Thank you as well.
Adam Robinson, executive director of the Rape Victim Advocacy Program. The summit, What About Men, is coming up Wednesday afternoon at the University of Iowa at the Iowa Memorial Union. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.